Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session today, you may press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Elwin Grant. You may begin.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us for today's media telebriefing on an article titled Quitting Smoking Among Adults, United States, 2001 to 2010, published in this week's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. My name is Elwin Grant, and I am the Acting Branch Chief for CDC's News Media Branch. Dr. Tim McAfee, and that's spelled M, small c, capital A, F-E-E, who is the Director of the Office on Smoking and Health, will make some brief remarks about the study, and then we'll open it up for questions. Joining Dr. McAfee during the question and answer session will be Anne Malache, and that's spelled M-A-L-A-R-C-H-E-R. Dr. Malache is Senior Scientific Advisor for the Office on Smoking and Health and is also the lead author for the report. At this time, I will like to turn it over to Dr. McAfee.
Great. Thank you very much, Ellen, and thank all of you for being online and your interest in this topic. This study is being released today, a week ahead of the Great American Smokeout. And just to give a little plug, that the American Smokeout is an annual event sponsored by the American Cancer Society that encourages smokers to quit for at least one day, and then this process often challenges them to go on and stop permanently. This year's Great American Smokeout will be held on Thursday, November 17th. So currently, just under 20% of adults in the United States smoke. And what this study looked at was how smokers are thinking about quitting, what kind of actions they're taking around quitting, what kind of success they're experiencing, and how they are interacting with their healthcare providers and the use of medications and counseling, which have been shown to be effective. And what we found, and this was done with the National Health Interview Survey, which is a household survey of was done of about 27,000 U.S. Americans. And what the study found was that about 68.8%, more than two-thirds, of concurrent adult smokers say that they want to completely stop smoking. And within the 25 to 64-year old range, this is actually an increase in quit attempts, which are at the level of about 52.4% for all current adult smokers. And a quit attempt for this study means that somebody quit successfully for at least one day or more. So this is not somebody with an idle thought, oh, I think I'll quit for a few hours. They had to actually abstain from cigarettes for at least a day. This study also found that about 6% of smokers successfully quit within the past year. Now, there was quite a bit of variation from different subgroups that we looked at for all of these elements. However, one of the most exciting findings from our perspective was that if you looked at all of the different subgroups that we looked at, which ranged from age, sex, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, for all of these different groups, more than half of the smokers were interested in quitting completely. Other things that we found were that about one in three smokers who tried to quit used counseling and or medication when they made their attempt. And this means that there is significant room for improvement in this arena because these use of these treatments can double or triple success rate. We also found that a little less than half of smokers who saw a health professional in the past year recalled getting advice to quit. And since advice from health professionals can be of assistance in increasing the chances that somebody will make a quit attempt as well as that they will be successful, this is also an area where we can healthcare providers can increase their patients' chances by identifying tobacco use and giving brief cessation advice. And healthcare administrators and insurers and purchasers can increase the successful cessation by providing comprehensive coverage for these treatments without deductibles or copays. There were a couple of other specific areas of interest within subpopulations that I'll manage, and then I'll see if Dr. Malachet has anything to add, and we'll open it up for questions. Of particular interest was the fact that there were marked differences in recent successful cessation based on the level of education of responders to the survey, ranging from 3.2% for people who have less than a high school graduate education versus 11.4% for those who had completed a college degree. And another very important finding is that somewhat paradoxically, non-Hispanic blacks had the highest interest of any group in quitting and the highest quit attempt rate of any group in quitting, but had the lowest rate of recent successful quitting, 3.3%. And we also found that they were less likely to use counseling or medication, with 36% of whites versus 21.6% of blacks using counseling or medication. This is a group that also is three times more likely to use menthol cigarettes, with the Tobacco Product Scientific Advisory Committee of FDA found that menthol decreases likelihood of success quitting. So both of these two factors may have contributed to this lower successful cessation rate. There were also variations with health professional advice. The health professional advice was almost twice as high for those over 65, with a rate of 57%, versus those who are 18 to 24, which had a rate of 31%. We did again see one of the most encouraging pieces of news in this was that for 25 to 64-year-olds, over the past 10 years, we have seen an increase in annual quit attempts. So with that, I'm going to see if Dr. Malachet has anything to add, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thanks, Tim. I just had one clarification. When we looked at whether smokers made a quit attempt in the past year, it was for greater than one day. So they reported if they quit for more than one day in the past year. Thanks.
Okay, Shirley, I believe we are now ready to take some questions.
Thank you. Now, this time we're ready to begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name clearly. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And one moment for our first question. Thank you. And our first question comes from Mike Sobey from Associated Press. You may ask your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I was interested in the statistic that less than half of smokers, 48%, saw a health professional in the past year reported receiving advice to quit. I was wondering, could you compare that to earlier years? Is there a trend? Are they getting counseled to quit less often than they used to or more often?
Yeah, well, that is a very good question, and unfortunately, I'll give you two. The first answer is that number is lower than numbers that were in prior surveys. We frankly are not sure what to make about this because there actually was a change in the survey instrument in how the question, the wording remained the same, but there was a preceding question about whether a health professional asked the participant about tobacco use, and that question was removed for the 2010 survey. So we think there's one possibility. We are not sure whether this is a real trend finding or if it's simply an artifact of a change in the way that the survey questions were administered. Anne,
yes.
Do you have anything to that?
Yes, I'll just add that there are other national data sets that surveys that examine whether smokers received advice to quit, and they're showing no change over time. So that's why we're questioning whether this, slight decrease is really real or not, given that the questionnaires did change from 2005 to 2010.
And basically, those were in the high 50s to 60%.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Corwin with Augusta Chronicle. You may ask your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. That 6% quit rate, can you compare that to any sort of historic trend? Is that better or worse than what we've seen in the past? And if there's any sort of cross-correlation between the number of people who are getting counseling or medication to help?
Yes, so we think that really has not changed over time. I think the issue there is that this, we typically have not published this measure in the past. It is a new measure for tracking for the Healthy People 2020 objective. And why we added that measure for those objectives was we really want to look at recent success. So we hope to move the needle and get more people to quit each year over time.
And again, we don't have a very good comparator, but the thing that was most striking was the variation between different groups, again, with particularly education having an almost threefold difference, but there were also variations in age with a lower cessation success rate in those, for instance, between the ages of 45 and 64, and then we had the markedly lower success rate for Black non-Hispanics.
And I'll just add the one thing that we did see a trend in, and it was a positive trend for people age 25 to 64, was it looks like over the past 10 years they increased their quit attempts.
Any correlation between insurance coverage and those rates?
There is variation on several of these categories related to insurance rates. With the lowest, and this is not surprising, the lowest rate is for the uninsured. And again, the people that are uninsured are both, of course, there's also overlap with having lower educational status and higher poverty rates, but they also are, they're less likely to see a physician, and if they see a physician, they're less likely to be advised, and they're less likely to use, they're the lowest group for use of medications or for receipt of counseling, whereas, for instance, and private insurance is higher, 7.8%, with military insurance being the highest of all at over 9%.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this question comes from Maya Solovitz with Time Magazine. Let me ask your question.
Thank you. I actually have two questions. The first is, do we know how the people who successfully quit did so?
We have not done a sub-analysis. This is really a surveillance report for MMWR. We are intending to do a deeper dive in this data set for to look specifically at the people who succeeded. We do know that of those who made a quit attempt, we know that just under a third of them used medication or counseling.
But we don't know if they succeeded, and we don't know if that affected their success rate.
Exactly. And I would hasten to add, this is an area that is often, I think, misunderstood not just by the media or the public, but also by people within the tobacco control area. One of the challenges around this is what's called selection bias. So,
right.
And it's not a random decision as to whether somebody uses counseling or uses medication. So there's no question from the basis of dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of large, very well-conducted clinical randomized trials with thousands and thousands of people, that use of medication and use of counseling, at least within the context of that kind of setting, significantly increases the likelihood of quitting. That there have been population studies that basically look at particularly use of over-the-counter medications and how, whether you're more or less likely to quit. And some of those have not found a difference. If you just look at, you know, the number of people in California that used nicotine replacement and compare it to other people in California who quit without it, and then the rates may be equivalent. The problem with that is it may be an unfair, we don't really know if that's what's going on, because it may be an unfair comparison, because people who have a harder time quitting, they maybe smoke at higher, at large numbers of cigarettes, be more addicted, et cetera, they may be more likely to use the medications or to go into counseling.
Right.
So it still may be giving them a benefit, but the benefit may just bring them up to the level of what a more casual smoker would come. We don't really know the full answer to that question.
Okay, and the other question I had was regarding the use of Chantix, which has come under some controversy lately, although the data seems to be that it is actually more effective than the other medications, and I wondered if you had any sort of guidance for people on that.
Well, the short story on that one to me is I think this is an area that is somewhat controversial and that, as you stated, the evidence for effectiveness is very strong for varenicline, and there are somewhat conflicting results about the likelihood that these neuropsychiatric effects are actually due to varenicline, or whether they're due to other factors. So the best advice is to talk to your doctor about this and have a solid conversation about the pros and cons of it. There have been really two studies recently with quite conflicting results. One, several studies that the FDA did that were large randomized trials that did not find virtually any relationship between hospitalizations for serious mental health problems. But then there was a recent study last week that simply looked at what the FDA, complaints to the FDA or reports of adverse events to the FDA, and did find a higher rate. But, of course, there was a lot of publicity about varenicline that was coming out at that time. So it's hard to interpret this, and there's difference of opinion within both the clinical, medical, and public health community about this.
Okay. And is it still the case that most people who do quit successfully do so without any help?
Yes. Yeah, it's probably not that a majority of people do it without at least structured, organized assistance. They don't sign up for a program, and they don't use a medication. There's far more using it now than did, say, 10 or 15 years ago. But it's still somewhere in the range of 20 to 30% of people that would be using a medication or signing up for formal counseling. But many people are getting, you know, more brief. That does not include people who got, for instance, brief counseling from their physician.
Thank you. And again, if you'd like to ask a question, press *1. Our next question comes from Steven Reinberg with Health Day. You may ask your question.
Yeah, I was wondering, this same 20% seems to have been basically the same over the past several years. Is this a group that is very hard to reach, or are we making progress?
I'm sorry, are you referring to the smokers?
The 20% of smokers, of Americans that still smoke.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think we're very, I mean, I think one of the things that this specific study does is it was actually reassuring to us, because particularly like 5 years ago or so, I think there was a lot of concern that as we were decreasing the level of the percent of smokers in the country, there was concern that we were having what would be called hardening, meaning that the remaining smokers were becoming less and less interested in quitting, they were becoming less and less actually making quit attempts and less successful when they did. And in fact, what this study shows is quite the opposite, that in fact the enthusiasm for smokers for becoming non-smokers, their actual behavior of making a serious quit attempt is at least the same, and in some cases actually higher than it was 10 years ago. So this is, I think, and the flip side of that is it means that what we're concerned about, honestly, is that society has been losing its enthusiasm for supporting smokers, and we've seen a degradation in funding by the states over the last 3 years that is deeply concerning, especially considering that the increasing amount of money that they're bringing in through taxes and the master settlement agreement.
So is this 20% being filled up again by new smokers? Is that what's happening?
Well, ultimately, that is what is happening. But to be clear, we are continuing to decrease. I mean, we did come out. We had an we've had a couple of NMWRs that looked at this. One a couple of months ago that showed that again there has been a decline over the last 5 years in the rate of smoking. It's not as fast as the previous 5 years, but it's still significant. There were 3 million fewer smokers between 2005 and 2003 than there would have. And smokers are actually smoking less. We're seeing that even among smokers that continue to smoke, there's more people who are smoking less than daily, and smokers that smoke daily are smoking fewer cigarettes. Now I think you raised the issue of the replenishment with youth, and we think this is incredibly important, and it's perhaps the most dangerous situation that we are in that we have seen over the past 5 years a flattening of the downward trend for youth initiation. We're very worried that there's a number of things that have been happening in terms of the tobacco industry marketing techniques that flow over and affect youth, the use of promotional discounting for cigarettes and other tobacco products and the increased exposure in retail outlets and a number of other factors have us very, very concerned that we may need to be more aggressive as a society around protecting our children, for whom this is an illegal drug, from the marketing and distribution practice, from marketing and distribution practices.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dina Vienna with Congressional Quarterly. You may ask your question.
Thank you. I wanted to get back to the issue of insurance coverage of cessation programs and medication. Do you know what the level of coverage is for Medicare and for Medicaid in particular? Is this something that's a mandatory coverage issue in Medicaid, or is it up to individual states? And what are you seeing as the level of Medicaid coverage and Medicare coverage?
I'll start a little, and Dr. Malachet can chime in. Medicaid currently does leave most of this up to the discretion of individual states, with the exception of pregnant women, for which they have a mandatory coverage requirement. The fact that they're leaving it up to the states is actually a new development, though. Up until last spring, they made it very difficult for states to provide any coverage for tobacco treatment services. So it was a major step forward that they're allowing states to provide coverage. They're also allowing some administrative matching for federal administrative matching for states for quitline services. They'll do a 50% administrative match. We have some incredibly exciting data from an experiment that Massachusetts ran from 2005 to 2007, where they markedly opened up access to all forms of cessation treatment in Massachusetts, and they aggressively promoted them both to the general public, to people on Medicaid, and to hospital and clinic systems, as well as individual physicians. and they saw a dramatic decrease over a two-year period in smoking amongst Medicaid Medicaid recipients, a decrease of 10 absolute percentage points, which is an incredible population effect and almost unprecedented.
Did the reason that these states got that opened that up to states to do these programs, did that have anything to do with the Affordable Care Act, or was it included in some other separate administrative ruling?
I think both factors are relevant. The Affordable Care Act does have provisions within it that require insurers over time to provide insurance coverage, but most of those do not come into full effect until 2014 or 2015. And so Medicaid, a lot of this is momentum that CMS in Medicaid has, because they've done the math. And I didn't mention this, but in Massachusetts, they are now in the process of completing health economics healthcare utilization studies, where they found a dramatic decrease shortly after the decline in smoking amongst Medicaid recipients in hospitalizations for particularly cardiovascular disease, but also some respiratory diseases, and found that they got a 3-to-1 return on investment for the money that they'd spent for coverage from decreased hospitalization costs within 2 years, which is again quite remarkable. So I think this is something that Medicaid, both because their charge is to improve the health of people on Medicaid, but also because they're trying to do this in a cost-conscious manner, they're trying to more aggressively address tobacco use among Medicaid members.
I'll just add, for Medicare, coverage has been expanded over the past 2 years. Prior to about 2 years ago, coverage was only for people with a smoking-related disease, and now coverage of these effective cessation treatments is for all people covered by Medicare.
There are also several other things that are happening shortly that will probably have a significant impact on this. One is that the Joint Commission, which accredits healthcare organizations and programs in hospitals in the U.S., has developed a set of voluntary performance measures for hospitals for assessing and treating tobacco dependence in all hospitalized patients. These are still voluntary, but it's one of a small number that they choose from that will affect their accreditation.
And the only other thing I'll add is that, of course, coverage is not the only thing that we need to have in place to have people utilize the services. People also need to be aware that these treatments are, and so there should be promotional aspects to the insurers where they promote this coverage to their clients and make them aware that they have this coverage so that they can take advantage of it.
Thank you. Our final question comes from Denise Mann with WebMD. You may ask your question.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my questions. And looking at this data, sort of taking a macro level look at it, says that most people do want to quit. More than half have tried, and yet maybe their doctors aren't speaking to them as much as they could or should be. How would you sort of take this together, and how can we sort of bridge these two things and get more people to quit, whether November 17th or or beyond?
Well, that is the big question that you've asked, and I think the good news is we have a whole series of pretty well-tested both policy-level interventions, health systems interventions, and individual-level approaches, all of which work. That's one of the really appealing things about trying to do something about smoking and tobacco use. This is why the Center for Disease Control has made this one of our 6 winnable battles, because we think it's possible within a relatively short period of time to have a dramatic impact on the health of the American people. So at the highest level, we need to keep moving forward with the policy changes, the changes in our environment that we know make it easier for smokers to do what they want to do, which is to quit successfully. And these include extension of comprehensive clean indoor air ordinances from the 25 states that have already passed these to the remaining 25. We also need to do more to address the issue of price and cigarettes. The tobacco industry is spending about $7 or $8 billion a year trying to undercut the price of tobacco in a systematic way to keep people smoking. And we also need to do more in terms of the state programs that have been so effective over the last two decades, where you've had the aggressive programs like California that have drastically, by just continuing year after year, working at the state and community level, and by having continuous counter-advertising campaigns in the media. And probably one of our biggest concerns is that many of the states have drastically cut back on their efforts nominally because of the difficult economic times, but in some cases far in excess of other public health programs, despite incredible gains. We've seen lung cancer has begun to, we're winning the battle against lung cancer. Clearly with men, this has been going down, and even more so for women. But these decreases are the most dramatic in states that have had active tobacco control programs. And then finally, the healthcare systems and individual healthcare providers have the opportunity to make an incredible difference, because we know at least 70% of smokers see a healthcare provider every year, and they have the potential both to encourage people to make quit attempts because of the depth of the relationship and respect that they have, and also to help people who make a quit attempt to actually be successful by both the kind of simple recommendations that they can give in the clinic environment: get rid of your cigarettes when you quit, throw away your ashtrays, talk to your family and friends, think about what happened the last time you quit, try to avoid trigger situations. And they also have the capacity to make referrals to people to other cessation resources. If they don't have them locally, they can actually refer people to 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which is a telephone quit line service that operates with all 50 states. And then they also can provide support and information about medications that can help. And then finally, Tobacco users themselves and their family and friends and coworkers can help by supporting them at the individual level, and smokers themselves have the opportunity. Bottom line is to keep on trying to quit until they're successful.
One just follow-up question about the doctor counseling thing. Is it possible, I mean, if you don't tell your doctor that you smoke, and I think a lot of people probably wouldn't, anybody who smokes, you know it's bad, you know it's unhealthy, you know what's coming if you mention that you smoke. Do you think that it's just that they're not telling their doctor, in which case the doctor is not going to obviously tell them to quit if they're not aware that they smoke?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There's not a lot of evidence that people literally lie to their doctors about their smoking status. The only exception to that is there's a little bit more of that with pregnant women, and potentially in situations where there's actually some monetary damage that somebody might get in terms of insurance coverage or something. But other than those very specific situations, generally, studies that have been done that basically did biochemical validation have found that, you know, the large majority of people are, in fact, still honest with their doctors. That the bottom line, I mean, again, what we've been encouraging and what's been shown to work with doctors, doctors should not be nagging or harassing or making people feel bad about smoking, because again, a large majority of smokers want to quit. So, and there have actually been studies done in clinic systems that implemented systematic approaches to smokers, where the medical assistant who roomed the person asked them about smoking status, the doctor was taught techniques about how to give brief advice, and there was support And in every one of the cases where that's been done, if you then ask smokers a year later, 6 months later, just doing general satisfaction surveys, and you compared them to before the system went in or in other clinics, people's general satisfaction with the medical care that they're getting, it wasn't just that they felt better about how they were being dealt with around being a smoker, but their general, just being a patient in general, they actually appreciated the attention and the help that they got.
Get this time, I'll turn the call back over to the speakers.
Well, thank you, Shirley. I wish to thank you all for participating in today's telebriefing. To learn more about CDC's work in tobacco prevention and control, please visit our website at www.cdc.gov/tobacco. To learn more about CDC's work in saving lives and money through prevention, visit our website at www.cdc.gov/24-7. And also, earlier this year, CDC and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services launched Million Hearts, an initiative to prevent 1 million heart attacks and strokes over the next 5 years. Approximately 26% of heart attacks and 12% of strokes are attributable to smoking. For more information about this initiative, visit millionhearts.hhs.gov. A transcript of today's media telebriefing will be available later this afternoon. This concludes our briefing, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, and this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.